what does it mean to be authentic?
That's how crazy Keith Raniere was.
All that money doesn't buy justice. Justice will be served.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of NXIVM on Trial. I am Casey Seiler, the editor of the Albany Times-Union. This episode presents the second half of a forum that the Times-Union presented at the Hearst Media Center in October of 2019, featuring our managing editor for investigations, Brendan Lyons, who has been covering the NXIVM story for years, as well as Tony Natale, a former girlfriend and business partner of NXIVM founder Keith Raniere. Natale is the author of The Program, Inside the Mind of Keith Raniere and the Rise and Fall of NXIVM, as well as Rick Ross, a cult expert and sometime deprogrammer who was engaged in a 14-year legal battle with the secretive self-improvement organization. The first part of this discussion ended with Ross discussing his fear that he had almost been pulled into an email entrapment scheme by the organization, and the role played by Claire Bronfman, the Seagram's heiress who was a major funder of NXIVM and who took a guilty plea as part of the federal prosecution of Raniere and other members of the group. The first part of this discussion can be listened to on a previous episode of NXIVM on Trial. We hope you enjoy it.
Talk about Claire coming into his life through really Sarah, I think, right? She signs up first for a course in Mexico and convinces Claire eventually to get into the organization. How does that change the game for Keith Raniere to have someone with that amount of assets and who is falls under his spell, it seems, pretty quickly and through the end as well, notably not a government witness in this case?
Well, I think he realizes that, as they do in Scientology, terrorism by litigation is your best form to destroy someone that they deem to be a detractor. My bankruptcy was 8.5 years, 2 federal investigations, then the computer trespassing charges, the civil case, the case in Washington State that Mr. Greigel represented me in. I mean, it was just this, as long as you don't care what the outcome is. So if I sue you and I don't care whether I win or lose, you still have to defend yourself. So when you have that kind of money behind you, and I think Keith always has to cause a distraction. So what he does with his people is look over here and has them all looking at Rick's the bad guy, I'm the bad guy, all these people that are doing wrong. So it allows him to do what he wants to do behind the scenes. And as long as he had that core group of enablers that maybe didn't know everything but knew enough to allow him to take that next step, he was able to continue to do that.
And I think it was Joe O'Hara who had outlined his legal strategy many, many years ago and explained it to them and said, this is what they do, right? They fight you,
right,
on discovery, on everything. Every step of the litigation becomes warfare, drawn out, you know, detailed, expensive litigation. And like you said, it wears people down.
Sure,
In fact, at one time I was in communication, someone from Scientology communicated with me and acknowledged that they had explained how Scientology litigates to Keith Raniere. And so that was his underlying strategy, was to wear you out because you had to keep spending money to defend yourself. And then you would go bankrupt. Or in my case, I was fortunate to have, you know, a lot of pro bono lawyers who were willing to help me because of First Amendment issues. But other people who were being sued at various points were not that fortunate and were bankrupted by litigation. And to just explain it, these Bronfman sisters had hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, the Bronfman fortune at one point was somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 or $6 billion, until one of the Bronfmans, Edgar Bronfman Jr., lost about half of it. In fact, they used to call him the pinata. They would say, hit him with a stick and money comes out. And so the Bronfman girls who lived here in the Albany area, one of them bought a beautiful equestrian mansion with stables and a wine room and everything. They were an endless flow of money, over $100 million, according to many reports. And this was a litigation machine. Think of it. You're a lawyer and you're not very ethical. I would premise that. And I think the overwhelming majority of lawyers, there would be many lawyers who would quit Keith Raniere. They would say, we're done with you. You're not ethical. You're not a good client. We don't want to be involved with you. And there were different legal teams, firms that I would see head for the door and walk away from him. But there were significant lawyers who were billing $800 an hour, $500 an hour. I remember one lawyer had his son on the team and he was getting $500 an hour. And I'd sit there and think, how many thousands of dollars are being paid every hour we're here? And these lawyers didn't care that he was using litigation improperly. And they would just collect for their billable hours. And he would find lawyers that would do that after the many lawyers who would not do that quit.
And even in the end, he and his co-defendants go to trial, and Claire puts $14 million in a trust fund to pay for all of their legal defenses, including Keith's as well. So pivoting to the women, and we all know the stories now about the more recent secret sex club, they call it, with the branding of the women, and that was be his undoing. You saw signs of this early on, do you think, of the way he would surround himself with women, control them, maybe use them against, you know, it seemed that each one carried a secret in some respects. And what are the similarities that you see between DOS, the group that he formed, and his relationships with women through the 90s, especially in the 2000s?
I don't really see any similarity in DOS and the 90s women. I think that what Keith did was he experimented and then he escalated. Mm-hmm. So it's just my understanding that a psychopath will escalate. So how much can he get away with? And if he got away with this, how much can, what's his next step? And then finding the people that are willing to go along with that. My line in the sand was my line in the sand. I went through the first pilot program of executive success program. And at the end of it, I went, yeah, no, I need to get out of here. Never thinking that I had to implode my life or that it would be imploded in order for me to get away. And that 20 years later, I'd be sitting here talking to all of you. But he found people that he could motivate in a direction that he wanted them to get in. And then he compartmentalized them and isolated them. So in developing of, you know, Consumers Byline was a membership-based organization with business people, mostly men, not women, with young people that were really excited about this new up-and-coming business venture. And again, no internet. And then the next business that we went into was a health food business. So he wasn't getting that draw of a dollarizing and women fawning all over them. And then he met Nancy and he saw what Nancy could bring to the table in drawing people in. She's amazing on stage. She's a
charismatic,
very much so. She took me once to New York City. She said to me, I need you to observe something. Keith and I are working on something called laying in. And I said, well, what's that? She said, well, just watch the audience and you'll see. I'm going to try to get them to raise their hand. Now, this was a group of New York City judges, and it was traffic court cops. And she, you know, Nancy taught kind of meditation courses on how to relax and how to work through these processes. And she said, I want you to watch the room, and I'm going to get a certain percentage to raise their hand. And I went out there and I said, okay, and I watched, and they did. And it scared the crap out of me. She didn't say, okay, raise your hand, but it was all subliminal cues. And one of the things she shared with me early on was that the way that she was able to work with someone through hypnosis, through NLP, was trust. So the first level is you get someone to trust you. And then you tell them your secrets, and then you tell them, you know, the things that you're holding in, and you think that that's going to heal you. But those are the things they used against them. their original collateral.
Because of the web presence of the Cult Education Institute, yes, and the papers by Dr. Paul Martin, the clinical psychologist, who, by the way, was my co-defendant for over 13 years, as was psychiatrist John Hockman for many years. They also suffered. But, of course, the case was dismissed ultimately. But because of those papers and the web presence, there would be many victims of NXIVM that would contact me. And many people, by the way, in the Albany area who would call me that were troubled about activities in their neighborhood, things that they saw going on, women and Ranieri in the middle of the night, people they thought were illegal aliens staying in group housing in their neighborhood. I mean, it just went on and on. And when I compared notes with Jim Adato and with Dennis Yusko and others, I realized that things were escalating, that no matter what Ranieri got, he wanted more. If he got five women, he wanted 10 women. If he had 10 women, he wanted 20 women. No matter how much he got, he had to have more. And I think Rex Smith touched upon this very, very well. He was enabled in large part by the law enforcement that refused to deal with him. All of the people who received complaints over and over again and did nothing, they were speaking directly to Keith Ranieri. And what they were saying to him was, go ahead, Keith, it's okay. You can get away with anything. And so he kept escalating and escalating and escalating. And I think it's fair to say that he was a psychopath. I once asked the eminent psychologist Margaret Singer, you know, I was dealing with David Koresh, and that was another group that had harassed me and that I had gotten people out of. And I had asked her out of curiosity, is David Koresh a psychopath? And she said, Rick, all cult leaders are psychopaths. It's like a threshold requirement for their job. You know, they are all like that. But, you know, what we see with these people is they keep escalating and escalating. And I remember saying to Jim Adato, I am getting a feeling of dread, Jim. I am feeling like this is going to end, and it's going to end very badly. And I think he felt that as well.
And there's human suffering going on too. I mean, the emails you get them. I've gotten letters from women that were in this organization who have been mentally, you know, destroyed by this.
There were at least three women who had psychotic breaks. That is, they had a complete meltdown as a result of the training. And one of them called me, and they were treated not far from here by a psychiatrist, Carlos Rueda, who helped them when they were hospitalized. One woman ran naked out of an intensive in the streets of Albany. And then she was picked up and she was hospitalized. Another woman, not one of these three, killed herself. She paddled a kayak out into the middle of a lake in Alaska and killed herself. And then there was another suicide associated with NXIVM. And I think that Ranieri saw all of this, and he realized, I can get away with anything. And so things escalated to the point of DOS and the branding. And I'm not saying that the authorities are totally to blame. Obviously, Keith Ranieri was the perpetrator. But the fact that they ignored so many warnings, as Rex Smith said, and they did not heed those warnings, they enabled him. And of course, you're not going to see me crying for Claire Bronfman when she's sentenced in January. I mean, I know she was victimized by Keith Ranieri, and I know she might be down to her last $100 million, the poor thing. But I think that she was enabler number one. She funneled money to that man no matter what, and no matter what she read, no matter what happened. And the only good thing I can say about the Bronfmans, because I was in touch with Edgar Bronfman through intermediaries, is I am so glad that he died before his daughter was arrested and Keith Raniere was arrested so that he did not have to go through the pain of all of this. And I also want to point out that the Suttons, Rochelle and Morris Sutton, very fine people, and I was able to get two of their adult children out of NXIVM and a son-in-law. Michael, I was not able to get out, you know, as Brendan talked about. They also were my co-defendants and Stephanie Franco for over 13 years. During that litigation, they both died from cancer, and they were never able to see the end of this. And I just want to say that they were wonderful people and that they did something very brave, that their son Michael went through a period of estrangement and that they were deeply grieved by what happened to their family, but they persevered. And I think if they were alive right now to see what has happened as a result of that perseverance and that hard, hard road that they went through, mm-hmm. and I can remember how hard it was for them, they would feel it was worth it, that they were right, that Keith Raniere was a very evil man.
So I'm going to switch. Some of you, when you registered, you provided us with some questions, and we'll try to get to some of these. So, Tony, somebody asked, what have you needed to do to heal from this experience?
I think first and foremost, I needed to see the legal system work as it was supposed to, you know, work as it should, not terrorism by litigation, but to litigate, prosecute, and put away the people that have been terrorizing people like us for, unfortunately, for decades, and to see that wrong, you know, be written. And you know, and write this book. It's part of the healing process. It starts the healing process. The I call it the bones of the book. When the federal government asked me for my information, they said, "Hey, we hear you have a few things." I'm like, "You think?" My mom, who gives me parking spots and watches over me, saved everything. I mean, everything. When she got sick and I was moving my parents out of their home, she was yelling at the boxes that I was going to toss away because you're moving, they're sick and there's a lot going on. No, don't throw those away. And when the time finally came that the right people that were actually going to do something to stop this very litigious, dangerous group came, I started pulling out those boxes and going through those documents. And it took me about 3 months of processing to give them this information. It was looking at notes that she wrote that said, "This is important, look at this, this is a lie," and letters that she sent to judges and reporters and anyone that would listen to, you know, why won't they leave us alone? Why won't they stop? So in putting that together, it put together the basics, the bones for the book. And I've been told over the decades, you know, you should write a book. You should write a book. And I would say, well, there has to be an ending. And now that he's in jail, there's an ending there and part of it. So it's time to start the healing process with that.
And so I'd seen that the turning point for the criminal prosecution was, you know, to give credit to the Times does the story in 2017 on the branding of the women, the secret club. And that is, you know, it followed years of reports and stories of similar misconduct, sometimes even more egregious misconduct, I would say. And the U.S. Attorney's Office in Albany, somebody who used to work there acknowledged to me at one time that they said, you know, we dropped the ball. We should have put a team on this and we didn't. But when that story appeared now with a national audience, and you have the Eastern District of New York, which is a very large U.S. Attorney's Office, and they also specialize in what RICO cases. They do RICO cases against mob rings, against, you know, overseas criminal organizations. And they brought back, in fact, a prosecutor who was a RICO expert just to look over the shoulder on that case. And they built that airtight case. And it was, as federal prosecutions go, Mike, you might agree with this, I think it was very swift from investigation opening to indictment months later to superseding indictment down the road trial, and none of the witnesses that we all thought might testify even testified. Not, they didn't call Claire Brofman, they didn't call Nancy Salzman to the stand. They kept a very streamlined case and proved every single count. So that was, you know, and you were there for almost all of it, or all of it?
Every
all of it,
second.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was part of the need to see, you know, you watch this person, that these people that attempted to destroy your life and lives of people that you care about and so many others. You want to see how the system used properly. And the fact that the lead prosecutor was a woman, I think, was just amazing. She would stroll back and forth in front of him, and she was beautiful. She was thin. She had long hair. She'd wear 4-inch heels. God, I don't know how she had them on all day, but she did. And she'd look at him like, I'm exactly what you want, and you are never going to have this, and I'm going to put you away where you belong forever. It was great. It was great.
I think that was the poetry of it.
Yes,
all,
was that women.
That he terrorized women, but in the end, it was women who brought him down. Mm-hmm. And one of the pivotal players who was really kind of a breaking point was Katherine Oxenberg, the star of Dynasty, the television series. And she would call me, and I worked with her for months before she became public, because she wanted to get her daughter, India, out. And she had actually herself, with her former husband, the actor Casper Van Diem, had brought India into NXIVM. And when they left, thinking, this is nuts, we're getting out of this, she continued and would not leave. And Catherine would call me, and she tried everything to get India out very quietly. She wanted no publicity, no notoriety. And then at one point she said to me, Rick, there's no way that I'm going to get her out unless I bring this whole thing down. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to blow it up. And I thought to myself, how many times have I heard this? You know, I mean, I've heard many people that are angry at a cult, that are a family, say, we're going to blow it up. But Katherine Oxenberg, God bless her, she had the guns to do it.
She blew it up.
And she really went for it and made it her center of her life for a period of time, as you can read about in her book. And that was the celebrity, the rich person that Keith never counted on. He had used rich people and celebrities to lure people in, but it was a two-edged sword, and Katherine Oxenberg was the blade that helped to cut his head off.
Absolutely.
And she, I think, in many ways embarrassed the New York State authorities, you know, who had received letters from Sarah Edmondson and other people, complaints about illicit brain studies that are being conducted on them, and traumatic brain studies that were unsanctioned, non-peer-reviewed nonsense. And the doctor recently lost his license over it. It took a couple of years. But the initial reaction of the health department was to say, well, that's not really in our purview. That's not, a doctor patient relationship issue when this doctor is branding you. But then Catherine comes to town and meets with the attorney general, and then there's stories about that, you know, reaction from the health department. Suddenly now the governor is ordering the health department to reopen the case, and
and Catherine is basically saying to them, I am a celebrity, I am related to the British royal family, my mother is a princess, and I'm gonna work it.
And
if you don't do what you're supposed to do, I'm going to say, what's your name? I'm going to say, he told me that he wasn't going to do anything. I showed him the evidence. I told him about it. And he said he wasn't going to do anything. And I'm going to take names, and then I'm going to do interviews and name those names. And so she was resolute. I mean, she had her eye on the target, and I think it's an irony that Keith Raniere was brought down by women, and that, of course, Tony was ground zero for the women that would take him down, and then the prosecutor was a woman. I think it was poetic.
Let's segue on that. One of the audience questions was just about what makes well-educated women remain in a situation such as this, and that dovetails to another question about that asked, you know, what is the mentality of people, a attracted to an organization like this?
First of all, I've done 500 interventions across the United States. I've worked in every state except Wyoming, and then I've worked in Asia and Europe and Australia. I've been there 6 times. Everybody thinks it can't happen to me. Bull. It can happen to you. Out of the people that I have deprogrammed, 5 of those people were medical doctors. One was an orthopedic surgeon, another one of the top anesthesiologists in the world. All of them were taken in. If you think you can't be had, then why do they have celebrity endorsements? Why is there advertising? Why is there negative campaign ads? Because we are all persuadable, every one of us. And what Tony's touched upon is that when we're in a difficult time in our life, when we're in pain, when we're looking for something to give us some solace, that's when we're most vulnerable. And if I could see a common thread amongst the highly educated and very intelligent, even brilliant people that I've seen that have been coercively persuaded, tricked, and trapped into a destructive cult, the common thread would be they had the bad luck to run into a destructive cult at a very vulnerable time in their life. And the person who was bringing them in was very likely a coworker, a friend, a family member. That's how the Sutton children were recruited. First Michael, then he got his sister, then he got his brother, then he got his brother-in-law. He even got his parents to go. Edgar Bronfman did some NXIVM ESP training. So it's somebody you know, somebody you trust, somebody you maybe even love, who's saying, hey, this is great. And in fact, they are a true believer. They have been tricked. And another thing, people like Keith Raniere are inherently deceptive. They don't say to you, hi, I'm a cult leader. I would really like to brainwash you and make you my slave. And maybe even sex slave if you're lucky. No, that is not the way they come on. Instead, he would come on like this very humble, little scholarly, quiet person.
Monk-like.
Monk-like, and hardly the celibate. Yeah. I mean, but as Toni writes in detail in her book, but I think that he would come across as this very humble, this very nice guy. And the only way that you could see the wolf in sheep's clothing is if you disagreed with him. And I saw it. I was in court-ordered mediation with him, and he started preaching at me about his philosophy. And I said to him, you know what, Keith? I'm not here for your philosophy. I don't even care about your philosophy. I am here to settle a lawsuit. And I could see his lawyers going, yeah, you know, I mean, that's it. And so then he started getting red-faced because I had had the audacity not to just sit there as a supplicant and student in submission to him. And so the only way that you would see the dark side is if you disagreed with him, you pointed out something he did that was wrong, because he could never admit that. So don't think that the smartest people, the most talented people, as this group proved by the people that came here to Albany, who were wealthy, who were highly educated, who were at the top of their game, and they ended up under his thumb. And it's because we are all vulnerable, and there are predatory people out there, and we need to just look for them and be aware that they're there.
And so you may be thinking, well, what about the people who left? Wouldn't they blow the whistle? Wouldn't they come out and tell everybody this is nonsense? So look at the case of Stephanie Franco, who is a member of the Sutton family, right? Stephanie pretty much blows the whistle, but when she signs the credit card receipt for her class that she's taking with NXIVM, she fails to note the small print about her being prohibited from talking about the information, from sharing the information with anyone. She did relay the information, didn't even know about that confidentiality clause until it was too late. They came after her. So that was always our biggest hurdle. We could find NXIVM defectors, but but they were scared to death of going through what you guys were made to go through, because that sent a strong message. You do this, and we're going to get you.
But let me just say that Nexium v. Sutton, if you Google it, Nexium v. Ross or Nexium v. Sutton, is a pivotal legal decision made by the New York Second Circuit Court, which is that even with a non-disclosure agreement, a confidentiality agreement, if something is published in the public interest, it effectively trumps the non-disclosure agreement.
So fair use.
So Keith Raniere, ironically, does have a legacy. And his legacy is that he expanded the First Amendment through Nexium v. Sutton to give journalists like Brendan and the Albany Times Union a little bit more leeway to help get information from people that have signed such agreements.
But so many people were afraid to come forward because they knew what was going to happen. I mean, the subtlety that's expressed if you try to leave or you're going to leave. People did leave and go quietly into the night, some. And anyone else that spoke out was obliterated. I mean, that was just status. That's Nexium 101. You leave and now we're going to destroy your life.
I'm going to set up a question for you, because there was another question from somebody you had asked. Will there be more prosecutions at this point? People have wondered about Karen Unterreiner. How did she escape? And my understanding is Karen Unterreiner, who was part of his inner circle and a critical part of his inner circle, expected the knock on the door when Nancy and all these others got rounded up. It never came. They don't know why. But my understanding is that Keith could be tried in the Northern District for the charges that were severed out of his case in Brooklyn. They said, no, you don't have jurisdiction here. Those crimes took place in the Albany area. You can prosecute him there. The risk they run is that if he gets sentenced to life or something equivalent of life, and they have a second trial that's just piling on, they run the risk, I think, of setting up an appeal of some sort. A witness contradicts their earlier testimony, or he gets a new legal team that attacks, some way finds a way to unwind the first conviction. So I think if you see a very harsh sentence for him, you'll see the Northern District say, that's it, and game over. We don't need to take him to trial a second time. And the question to you is, what do you think he should receive?
Baba. I think that it's a little two-sided question. I think our legal system, as far as prosecuting people, is barbaric. What we do to people that are charged with white-collar crime and putting them in prisons with people that rape and murder is wrong. There's no way for someone to rehabilitate in a situation like that. And yet I think there's people like Keith Raniere that need to be put away forever. He's a danger to society. So whatever it takes to get him to the point where he never sees daylight again, I really think that's what needs to be done.
I think, judging by the judge's demeanor toward him during trial, I think Keith is going to face a hefty penalty. The question becomes then, the women who were his co-defendants, were they his enablers? Were they also victims? They were certainly a mix of both, some of them. And so you wonder, you know, whether their sentences, they might get away with home confinement. I mean, who knows? I think it might. What do you think there is in terms of?
Yeah, right. So in order for it to even be a RICO case, or for him to be able to get to the point where he did, they beautifully laid out an inner circle, as they call them, and one by one presented the people that were the people that enabled him to get to where he is today. You don't get to this point on your own, especially someone like Keith. The people that are now facing charges and looking at sentencing, there's sentencing guidelines that the government has to use. I watched that judge watch what unfolded, because when they did their allocution, when they pled to the charges that they agreed to with the prosecution before the trial, the judge wasn't aware of everything that went on. And I think that whether he can or can't, I don't know the laws on that. I think he's going to take into consideration the amount of damage that someone like Claire Brofman did with her money. the amount of damage that Nancy Salzman did with her way of manipulating and drawing people in, even her own daughter. I mean,
Well, they said that the jurors were emotional at times, and the judge, there was an attorney who was in the courtroom, and said to me that when one of the young Mexican girls who'd been abused by him was testifying, that it appeared to them that the judge actually wiped a tear off his eye. You know, it's just
it was
heart-wrenching.
It was more emotional than I ever expected it to be, and hearing things that were going on like in a parallel universe. So while he's suing me, suing my family, doing all these horrendous things to myself, to Rick, to anyone else that would he deemed as a detractor, you're in a parallel world where you're realizing that at the same time he's locking a girl in a room for 2 years. He has this harem of women that he has them all convinced that this was during his celibate monk phase. So while the inner circle knew what was going on and they were all having relationships, they helped to build that facade that he was a renunciant and that everything he said was should be believed. So he was building this force with that was just, it was unbelievable to the extent that he went to destroy people. The box that they fought so hard for in court, I think the discovery number was 204. It was a box that was found in Nancy's house. George Hirsch had his file in there. Anyone that they saw as an enemy, they did a full dossier on. So the amount of time and energy that was put into all of this was, it was frightening.
I think the one person I have the most sympathy for is Lauren Salzman. Okay. Lauren Salzman, her mother brought her into this cult when she was barely out of high school and college. I mean, this was her mother's idea. She brought her in, and Lauren Salzman spent years believing somehow that Keith Raniere loved her, that they would have a child together. And she was played and victimized, and she victimized others. She could be cruel. She could exploit people. She recruited women into NXIVM, and she will be punished. But it seems to me that her mother should be punished with a sentence longer than her daughter. Though the way that this plea bargaining process went out, it seems like Nancy Salzman will walk away with a relatively light sentence. And her daughter may end up getting a fairly severe one. And of course, the actress Allison Mack, who was in the television series Smallville, will probably get a very substantial sentence. And maybe the bookkeeper Kathy Russell might get probation or not that much time in jail. And my hope is that Keith Raniere will get at least as long a sentence as his last birthday, which would be, I think, 58 years.
And that's, you know, probably a product, too, of Nancy walked through the door first and pled guilty first. And so you often get the best deal because when they have a case and it's now an international audience and that U.S. Attorney's Office will make that sacrifice to say, the president of NXIVM wants to plead guilty, let's do it. And then you saw the house of cards crumble and Keith was left standing alone at the end.
And arguably Nancy Salzman threw her own daughter under the bus. I mean, that's what she did. She took a plea and got a good deal because he or she who pleads first usually does best. And so Nancy Salzman feathered her own nest and left her daughter to twist in the wind.
Yeah, the co-defendants, if we're to believe, you know, what the attorneys say, and I do, that they did not know she was coming in. They just knew suddenly there was a change of plea hearing. And they, you know, but they were also forbidden from communicating with one another. So she couldn't talk to her own daughter about it. She risked, you know, having that undone for her.
And she's so, you know, such a stand-up person that would have been a horrible thing to do to give her daughter a heads up, huh?
Yeah. So, Rick, any closing remarks?
Well, all I can say is this is the first time I've ever flown into the Albany airport. I did fly in it after midnight last night, and it was quiet and very hard to get a cab, by the way. And all I can say is I've been up to the capital city region many times, and the Hudson River Valley. I like Albany, Schenectady, Troy. And for so many years, I heard so many stories about the people that were suffering in this city because of Keith Raniere. And so many people in Albany, people that lived down the road, that lived next door, that were in the condo development, or that did business with Barbara Boucher, they would call me and they would say, there's this weird stuff going on. There's this guy, and he walks around with these women, and they're like skeletons, and they look like they're on drugs. I think maybe they're on drugs. And I would say, no, ma'am, they're not on drugs, you know, but they're on something, you know. And so now finally I'm here and we're talking about all of this. And for so many years, I felt like we were all talking into the wind. And finally, it's come to something and it's over. And I thank you for this closure. Thank you very much.
Anything?
Me? No, never. So I understand what the attorneys tell you, and the fact of bringing the other charges against Keith in the Northern District, that it could tip his appeal. But I do honestly believe that they've done a lot of other things here, that the Northern District, it's time for them to step up and take a look at what the things that they missed and do something to clean up some of the politics and some of the political things that went on to allow people to be persecuted and lives destroyed while they kind of turn, you know, a blind eye to that. So I would like to see that happen here. I would like to see some of that come to light. And offer a healing place for people so that they see that all that money doesn't buy justice, that justice will be served in the right way. And it's, again, it's thanking everyone, thanking the media has not been for the brave men and women that would relentlessly speak out under threat of being sued and stalked and harassed and pushed off boats. we would not be here. So it's not a one person that did this. It was collectively a group of people, and finally a perfect storm that happened that pushed him to the point where he was his detriment to himself, and he destroyed himself at the end. Thank you. Well,
all right, Tony. So I wanted to thank, of course, both our guests. I set up Rick's flight from Tucson, and when I booked it, I had to wipe a tear away as I looked at how many times he had to change planes, and it even, I think, rolled over into a different day. So thank you so much for making that trip. And Tony, thank you so much. You know, we've talked with Tony and known Tony at the Times Union for many years, and she had a mutual interest in the truth, as did Rick. And sometimes your reporting and the reporting of my colleagues, it's based on the strength and the credibility of your sources. And it's not a story that's over. We'll continue to cover it. I still drive by their houses once in a while. If you wonder, they're just sitting there, they're empty. And at some point the government's gonna take them, and hopefully some of those funds will go to the victims who deserve, I think, some compensation for what they were put through, certainly. And thank you all for coming out to our forum. It's a great way for us to kind of get together with the community to talk about cases like this and stories that we work on and hear your thoughts and you know, give you another glimpse of the sources without us whittling their comments down to three sentences. So thanks again, guys.
Thank you, everyone.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring in you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union member today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.